Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Every relationship is new and unblemished at some point. But inevitable challenges that couples face change all that. Sometimes for the better, and sometimes for the worse. Or maybe those challenges result in something in between. Cassie Underwood's experience is firmly planted in that in-between territory. Betty Gilpin, star of the Netflix series Glow, reads Cassie's essay, A Lost Child, But Not Mine.
On the third anniversary of my abortion, I found out via MySpace that my ex-boyfriend was having a baby with another woman. It was none of my business, except I somehow convinced myself that his new baby was a replica of ours. And as such, I felt a sense of ownership, of responsibility for the child's well-being. My college roommate in Vermont had introduced us. He was road weary that first night, having just driven up from a concert in Kentucky, my home state. He was 20, a ski lift operator, a community college student. I was a blonde, Episcopal-bred, 19-year-old studying literature and costume design. Early on, he told me he was on probation for drug-related offenses, which was forcing him to remain clean and sober. It was easy for me to accept his blemished past because I had my own struggles with drugs and alcohol, making me feel like Nancy to his Sid. He and I talked textbooks and compared rap sheets. In his ramshackle apartment, we belted out Bob Dylan songs as he twirled me across the sloping floorboards. He gave me piggyback rides up my dormitory steps and carted me around town on the handlebars of a bicycle. 2 months after we met, his probation ended. Without supervision, he began crushing up OxyContin and sucking the powder into his nose through a rolled-up dollar bill. On St. Patrick's Day, I stayed after theater class, sewing a corset. Clad in a threadbare flannel shirt, he stopped in to help me clip the bones. I hoped nobody could see the dope in his pinned eyes or the pregnancy in mine. My period was 2 weeks late. If it hasn't come by April, we'll take a test, he whispered. Several weeks later, after a university doctor delivered the news, he and I laid side by side on his bare twin mattress. I'm not ready to be a father, he said. I nodded, planting my head on his chest. I stared at the water-stained ceiling and prayed he would score a lucrative job instead of more OxyContin. I let myself imagine that I could clean up my own act and finish school, and we could hire an au pair and everything would be fine, but I knew it wouldn't happen that way. I had promised myself not to tell my parents, but when I called my mother in Kentucky, I burst into tears as soon as she answered the phone. In the background, my father said, "She's pregnant, isn't she?" It had been our collective worst nightmare. "Come on home," my mother sobbed. "We'll rear the child here." I told her I just couldn't. The truth is, I had ambitions. While I adored children and romanticized the idea of one day raising a small brood dressed in elaborate getups of my own design, I wanted a family on my own terms, happily married with enough money to live well. After college, after grad school, after I had started a career, there was no fantasy in raising a child alone. In deciding against adoption, I blamed alcohol, the chance that I had already harmed the baby with my drinking. But my ambivalence remained, and when I quit drinking, again thinking of the baby, my boyfriend was lucid enough to notice. We lay entwined on his secondhand couch one night when he muted the TV. "You want to have this baby, don't you?" he said. "We could call her Jade," I said. All 11 of my grandmother's siblings had names starting with J. Mick Jagger had a daughter named Jade. Naming her Jade would be a no-brainer. "Yeah, Jade's pretty," he said. "But we can't go through with it," I reassured him, reminding myself that we didn't have the emotional equipment. "It's better this way." In late April, heading to the clinic, he slept in the passenger seat as I fiddled with the radio. Most offices do not allow partners in the room during the procedure, but when I pressed my feet to the stirrups, he was there to knead my shoulders. I dug my fingernails into the nurse's hand. He and I watched each other instead of the ultrasound machine. I'm hot, I said. I'm blacking out. Please take off my socks. We've got to breathe, honey, the nurse said. Take off her socks, he hollered. His support and innate, if untraditional, sense of duty almost made me think twice about ending the pregnancy. I thought he might have been a nurturing father after all. I emerged from the appointment emotionally unscathed, or so I thought. The 5-minute procedure had ended my insufferable melange of nausea, exhaustion, and shame. I briefly saw a therapist, troubled that I did not feel guilty. Soon I started drinking again, was arrested for drunk driving, and was fired from 3 jobs for coming in slurring my words or for showing up late or not at all. While my boyfriend eventually disappeared into heroin. I waited for the countless rehabs to work their institutional magic on him, but they didn't. Our relationship ended on good, but very sad terms. Not long after we broke up, he met a girl at a music festival, and a couple of years later, she gave birth to their child, whom they named Jade, of all things. They managed to stay together during his stints in jail. By now, I was following them on Facebook, where they had migrated like just about everyone else. Meanwhile, I went into treatment. I quit drinking and moved to Austin, Texas for a job. With sobriety and a salary, I couldn't stop thinking about the baby that wasn't. A loss somehow made more painful by his baby that was. I spent my work days browsing photos of his little girl, believing in some twisted respect that I was glimpsing the face of the child I could have had. On lunch breaks, I went home to cry in bed, longing for a paranormal miracle. By the time I called him, his daughter was about to celebrate her first birthday. He was living at a halfway house in Boston, where my company was flying me for a conference. I harbored a secret motive to find out if he dwelled on the loss as much as I did, so I asked him if he would meet me. I figured I would bawl in his track-mark-scarred arms, we would plant a tree in remembrance, then we would raise our child in my studio apartment. He came ambling up to the corner on Newbury Street. I waited in a business suit, disappointed that he was not pushing a stroller. Gone was his shaggy brown hair, mischievous smile, and weather-worn Grateful Dead jacket. He had turned hip-hop, from his puffy white Adidas to his crooked white cap. His teeth had browned from the drugs. We sat down for cappuccinos in a fancy cafe where we could afford nothing else. He told me that his ex-girlfriend had recently drained his meager bank account and vanished, leaving her infant behind. He confessed that paramedics had recently resuscitated him after he overdosed in a restaurant bathroom. Rehab followed. Now he scrimped by on construction work. He aspired to save for a deposit on a roomy apartment for him and his child, who was living with his parents. I felt an urge to run to his parents' home and cradle his baby in my arms as if she were the responsibility I had avoided. I think a lot about what happened, he said. Me too? He stared into his steaming mug. But, I continued, if I had had that baby, you wouldn't have Jade. Could her name be a coincidence? Maybe when they picked her name, he didn't realize he was remembering. Oh yeah, he said, flashing a relieved smile. Something was lost, and he got to keep it. I drew my lips to match his cheery expression, even though I felt shorted. I had graduated with honors, seen the first book I edited published with my name in microscopic print, and been accepted to an Ivy League graduate program. I kept trying to secure the next accomplishment that would make my decision worthwhile. Meanwhile, he got Jade. Yet he couldn't take care of her. An overdosing jailbird father stared back at me, buttering crackers with a silver coffee spoon. The heat of summer hung down on our shoulders when we hugged on the bustling street corner. As we parted, I walked back toward the conference center. He headed toward the pickup truck he'd borrowed from a friend at the halfway house. In the 3 years since, he has spent much of his time incarcerated for drug-related offenses. I wish I could share my sobriety, my degree, and my career to rent that apartment for his little girl. But reality has finally sunk in. The abortion is mine alone, just like Jade is his.
Betty Gilpin, reading Cassie Underwood's essay, A Lost Child, But Not Mine. We'll catch up with Cassie after the break. We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's been 6 years since Cassie Underwood's Modern Love essay was first published, and during that time, she and her ex-boyfriend's paths have diverged even further.
My ex-boyfriend is now in jail, and he's basically been in and out of jail for the past 13 years that has passed since we had the abortion. And this time he's in for a pretty long time. They're all drug-related offenses, so he has addiction, and he just keeps getting incarcerated.
And Cassie says his daughter Jade remains with her grandparents. After her Modern Love essay, Cassie wrote a memoir about her experience. Her ex's father sent him a copy of it in jail.
And he read the book, and he wrote me a letter. So he was like, I'm so nervous to be writing you this letter. I hope it's okay that I do this, but I just wanted to tell you that I really loved the book. And he said, I have a lot more to say, but I just am writing to apologize for not being able to be more present.
Cassie received a lot of feedback after her essay was published. Many readers shared that they didn't have a place to talk about their abortions without being judged. It's a sentiment she's heard again and again. But something she didn't expect was criticism from pro-choice activists.
A strand of the pro-choice movement is not about hearing complex experiences around abortion. So I've actually had people tell me to shut up, to stop writing about what I'm writing, that my book worries them. And what's so ironic about it all is that people on the anti-abortion movement have read my book and told me that it made them question everything they thought they knew.
Cassie has moved on and continues to build her life. She's 11 years sober, married, and pregnant.
It was so different to call my mom and for her to be thrilled that I'm pregnant, and for me to tell my partner, who's my husband, and for him to be thrilled, and just to have that support. It was just a totally new experience.
Cassie Underwood. Her memoir is May Cause Love. She works as a private coach and public speaker. She lives with her husband in Massachusetts. Coming up, Daniel Jones on how the Modern Love column helps explore gray areas around controversial subjects. Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says Cassie's strong ambivalence about her abortion helps others to understand the complexities of the experience.
You know, abortion is such a loaded subject and a polarizing subject. And in politics, it's so black and white. You're either on one side or the other. And I think this is at its best what the column can do. It can take something that people already have fixed ideas about and shows you an individual path through that's not as clear and doesn't lead to condemnation and doesn't lead to celebration. It's just like, this is the result of our choices. And it's so stark at the end when she talks about the child being his and the abortion being hers.
Dan Jones. His latest book is Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subjects with the help of 50,000 strangers. We asked Betty Gilpin why she chose Cassie's essay.
I guess I connect to people being close to drug users, watching their experience in a similar way, a reason why I became an actor or why people become politicians, or I think everybody's trying to touch the divine in their own way. And some people do it in a healthy way, and some people throw their lives away. And I thought this was a beautiful way of looking at that.
Thanks to Betty for reading this week's essay. You can see her now in the new Netflix series Glow, based on the 1980s professional wrestling league, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. Coming up next week, Cynthia Nixon shares the story of two grown siblings and their decision to come out to their 95-year-old father.
"You really think he needs to know?" I asked. "How is this going to help him?" "It's not for him," Charles said. "I'm doing this for me. I'm over 60 years old, and he still thinks I'll get married if I find the right woman. I don't know what he'll do with this, but I need him to know who I am."
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. Our intern is Megan Mooney. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. You can always get more Modern Love on Facebook. Join the community at facebook.com/modernlove. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.